If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps me out a lot. Cheers.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Novel Analyst Podcast. My name is Jed Hearn, author of the fantasy books Across the Broken Stars and Fires of the Dead. And today I am joined by S. Andrew Swan. S. Andrew Swan is the pen name of Stephen Swinasi. He has published over 26 novels since 1993, which is insanely impressive. And his recent works include Sword of the Slayer, an interactive fiction story from Choice of Games, which I just read slash played recently, and I loved it so much to reach out to Stephen, who has decided to come on the show. So thank you for being here, Stephen.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
So Sword of the Slayer really, really interests me because I'm a huge fantasy reader, and I've just gotten into playing a couple of different Choice of Games, which are these interactive choose-your-own-adventure stories with a great level of depth to them. And I've probably played about 8 or so of them over the last few months. And I'm not just saying this because you're here, but Sword of the Slayer is my absolute favorite one. So I was wondering if you could talk me through some of your inspirations for that and how you approach Choice of Games to work on that particular story.
Well, that story is sort of like a distillation of a lot of different fantasy tropes that I decided to sort of like meld together, somewhat spiritually based on a short story I wrote a while ago. It was in a Marty Greenberg anthology called Man and Machine. It's called The Historian's Apprentice. It's not quite the same animal because The Historian's Apprentice was a bit of a stylistic experiment as well, as sort of a homage to Gene Wolfe. But the setting, the sort of claustrophobic and confined city is sort of reminiscent of the kind of backstory in history I was working with The Historian's Apprentice, and that's where most of that came from. And the monster hunting element actually sort of came from a completely different direction. It's like I'm sort of like partially inspired by Larry Correa's Monster Hunter series, which is sort of gun heavy urban fantasy. And it's a lot of fun. So it's like I sort of like pick pieces of that, you know, for part of the setting, just to have a, basically so it has a plot. And the sword is my own thing. And, you know, I sort of wanted the magical artifact to be a character in the story. So I had a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, I definitely found the setting very immersive. And it's always a fascinating thing for me when it comes to fantasy stories as to finding out for authors whether it was the plot that came first or the characters or the setting. With this game, which one of those three elements was the, I suppose, initial burst of inspiration for you?
I think the sword was the initial. That's the interesting thing about writing the Choice of Games is you're sort of coming at it from outside the character, because basically the philosophy of the Choice of Games is they want the protagonist to be sort of as flexible as, you know, the various different players. So you can't hinge a lot. Well, that's not quite true. You can hinge things on the player's character, but it's character as revealed by the player's actions. So the protagonist is sort of mutable. It's like you can end up with, you know, this, you know, real, you know, nasty, evil protagonist, or this, you know, upstanding, upright protagonist, depending on what the player does during the game. So you really can't necessarily base the plot per se, at least the core plot, on the protagonist's character. It has to sort of come from the outside in order for the work, and then sort of like dovetail that with what the player does. So, you know, it's a complicated beast.
Yeah.
Where I started, I started with the sword, the idea of the sword, and, you know, basically starting the game with this sort of everyman protagonist, every woman protagonist, coming across this, you know, enchanted sword in this sort of decadent fantasy setting, and, you know, sort of becoming... Then this is a trope I've done. It's like there's a trope in fantasy. It's like the chosen one. It's like, you know, the protagonist becoming the linchpin of, like, you know, major epic things. And often that's an accident by birth in a lot of fantasy stories. And my chosen ones tend to be not born to it, and generally not necessarily particularly adept at it. So I, you know, I like the idea of the protagonist that could have been anyone and just happens to be this person through some, you know, accident of fate that thrusts them into the situation, rather than having it be something, you know, inherent.
Yeah. And you certainly get that sense with, the protagonist is Sword of the Slayer as well. But you picked up on a really interesting thing there, because to me, Sword of the Slayer kind of reminds me a little bit of The Name of the Wind, in the sense of it sort of recontextualizes a lot of these classic fantasy tropes in a way that feels fresh and unique. And in Name of the Wind, I think that's because of the prose that Rothfuss writes in. It's very, like, immersive, and, you know, some would say purple, but I find it really engaging. And with Sword of the Slayer, it's getting those tropes recontextualized, because you are the character and you're interacting with the story now, rather than just being a passive observer of it. So I'm very happy to hear that was sort of a intention of yours, to sort of meld all these different fantasy tropes in together. Were there any tropes that you wanted to kind of include that you couldn't because of time restrictions or the medium restrictions?
Well, it's not that I, like, necessarily started out with a pile of tropes that I wanted to use.
Okay.
I worked through this and basically grabbed stuff as I needed and fit them into the story as necessary. So I, you know, I didn't come away feeling that I had missed something. Although, you know, it's like, I could have done, you know, maybe some more of, you know, the sort of nasty side effects of the sword, if you were. It's like, that was sort of confined mostly, those side effects to the end. You know, there was some foreshadowing involved in some of these choices, but if I had more space and more time, I could have probably done that a little deeper and had a little more time with that than necessarily the various endings.
I certainly found it worrying whenever because I'm one of those choice of games players who likes to constantly check the stats and see sort of how the relationships with all the characters are going and how my different, you know, attributes are and everything. And I was certainly very worried when I saw a stat there that was like, thrall to the sword. And I got really afraid about following its orders from that point.
Yeah, that definitely counts as foreshadowing. It's
not... Yeah, that was cool. But I found it very engaging. And I was wondering if there's any lessons that you've learned, because this is the second choice of games story that you've written after Welcome to Morrytown, is that correct?
Yeah, that's I've done two of them.
Great. So what are some of the lessons that you learned from that first experience, or perhaps mistakes you made from the first experience that you learned from for Sword of the Slayer?
I think keeping control of how things are branching was a good lesson. It's like there was in Welcome to Morrytown, there was a real proliferation of endings that was really sort of difficult to deal with. It became this sort of Gordian knot of code in the back end. I mean, it's like, it's great for the player. You had like all these, you know, different things that could happen, but it's like, you know, in terms of writing the thing, it was a little bit of a nightmare. In Sword of the Slayer, I actually tried to keep things a little more modular so that, you know, the various pieces could work independently of each other. So I didn't have one event that like changed like five different things at once.
Yeah, okay, that's a pretty useful lesson. And you do get that sense because it's sort of divided into different chapters. And yeah, it would seem like you could quite easily have, you know, a lot of these different options in like one chapter, but then it sort of comes back to the same climax, but maybe from like a different angle or from a different interpretation. So I think that worked out really well. So you've had a really like quite long and extensive publishing career, which inspires me a lot, because I hope this doesn't make you feel old, but your first book was published 5 years before I was born. So this is quite impressive. What have you learned over that? What are some of the lessons, I suppose, that you've learned over publishing? Is it 26 novels or so?
Yeah. Well, one thing is, that you never stop learning about stuff. It's like you're never done. The choice of games is a great example. It's like I dove into that, and it's like and I had already been writing for 20 years prose, and it's like, you know, a completely different way of writing and different narrative style, and it's as different from writing prose as, you know, like script writing is from poetry. I'm lucky in that, you know, my day job, I'm a database manager. I'm familiar with code. So it's like, I happen to have actually the two core skill sets you need to do this sort of thing. And even so, it was a learning experience getting the interactive fiction part of it to work. So it's like plotting one of those things is very difficult. It's like you plot off in one direction, you write a little bit, then you have to back up and say, okay, now you do this and this happens, and then you back up again and it's like you do this and then this happens, and it's it's very complicated. And it's like if you're not careful, it can really spill out of control on you.
Yes, definitely. And I think one of the interesting things I've sort of picked up from my research into various choice of game writers and everything is you have to make an outline for choice of games before they sort of decide for you to start writing a game and everything. How much detail do you then put into your own planning beyond that point? Or are you more of a sort of organic writer who prefers to just let the story unfold and then maybe like pull it back to where it needs to be?
Well, in terms of outlining, the outlining I did for Choice of Games really ends up being the master outline for the game. And within that framework, I'm generally writing within, sort of like pantsing it within these various chapter beats I have. And I've been... In my writing career, I've done both. I've I've written novels completely from the seat of my pants, starting out at page one, writing through to the end, no outline, no nothing, no net. And I've written very detailed outlines of books. And it's like the ones I outline are not necessarily the ones that you'd suspect I outline. Like my Hostile Takeover and Apotheosis trilogies are both like, massive space opera, cast of thousands. It's like, different things happening on different planets at different times. Didn't outline those at all. It's like that was complete seat of my pants. The only outlining I did was sort of retroactively just keeping track of plot beats so that if I threw a plot thread up in the air, I caught it before the book ended. The most detailed outline I ever wrote was for Dragon Princess, which is about a 75,000 word humorous fantasy. And I think I did the outline for that so detailed because that was my first sort of like headlong dive into, unrepentant humor, which I'd never done before. And I outlined most of my jokes.
That stresses me out so much that you wouldn't outline like a massive space opera thing. That would do my head. I'm like a very big outliner, so it just makes me worried when people are like, oh yes, I've got thousands of characters and I'll just keep it all up in my head. But obviously it works out. Do you think that's because you just have like a lot of experience with the genre? So maybe if you might not be consciously outlining, but you sort of like have all of the plot structure and all of those sort of basic foundational things ingrained into you?
Well, I mean, there's probably a bit of that going on. And I also think it's just, the thing about plotting is not so much, coming up with the incident. The plotting is when you resolve the incident. So it's like, throwing balls in the air is easy. It's just, you need to keep track of them as you can, so that you can catch them before the end. They're all, somebody's going to be wondering, it's like, what happened to that character on page 50 that left screen and never came back? So I've been good at keeping tabs on, the plot threads I've been throwing out. I mean, that's basically the gist of it. It's like I need something to happen, I make something happen, and by the time I get midway to two-thirds of the way through, it's like I don't need to come up with anything more. I just need to resolve the stuff I already came up with in the first 23 chapters or so. So I think it's gauging where that tipping point is, where you focus, less on new problems and more on resolving the old ones. It's like knowing where that point is like the key to successfully pantsing a novel.
That's a really interesting way of thinking about it. And I've never considered that before. Yeah. Like where do you find that point where you sort of the trajectories of all the balls you've thrown in the air start to arc downwards, and how do you catch them all at once? And I suppose it's almost like a matter of, maybe you launch them at different points, but for me, like the really successful climaxes are where you sort of catch them like all in one go and they all just weave together into that one movement, I suppose.
Yeah, and in fact, I think that I've mentioned this online before, but this is the difference between a tightly plotted novel and a well-plotted novel. A well-plotted novel is, it's like there's nothing extraneous going on. It's like everything that's brought up is resolved. Everything contributes to the events leading to conclusion, but they're not necessarily simultaneous. They can be episodic. They can be, in sequence. I mean, a good example of what I think is a well-plotted novel, it would be American Gods by Neil Gaiman.
Yes.
It's like, there's a lot of tangents in there. A lot of them. But they all contribute to the overall whole. And, you know, they're episodic. It's like, you know, there's a plot thread that could start in the middle and then end, like, in the middle. And but it's like, you know, it all fits together, and it's a really nice experience to read. Tightly plotted novel, which I've been told that my space operas are, even though they've been pantsed, happens when what you said happens is when, you know, a lot of the plot threads are basically brought together into a single conclusion. So that in addition to everything being necessary and everything, you know, having a resolution, there's sort of like an ultimate resolution to everything, more or less at once.
That's a really good definition. Yeah, and I love American Gods too. And I definitely get what you're saying, because on first impression, it's a very rambling novel that just sort of goes to all these different places and you know, maybe like goes to a chapter with a character you've never heard before and then does almost like a short story with that character and then it's back to the main plot. But it does all feed into the same kind of unified tone and theme and everything. So that is a really good example. What are some other books that you particularly like look up to or think are just great examples of writing in general?
Oh, well, of course you asked that question. I mean, you know, in terms of just sheer fun, you know, I love Jim Butcher's Dresden series. I mean, that's just like, you know, that's like fun stuff. I mean, if you want, you know, it's like deep dive into space opera with sort of heavy themes. I would, you know, suggest like Peter F. Hamilton or even like Dan Simmons' Hyperion. Those are good. Let's see. And, you know, completely afield, it's like you know, my favorite horror novel, maybe The Fireman by Joe Hill, which is a book I probably would not recommend you read in this current situation unless you want to freak yourself out.
Okay. It tells me everything I need to know about it.
So there's a couple. I mean, there's like dozens of people. I mean, you know, in terms of influences, it's like my influences, you know, range from, you know, Stephen King to Larry Niven to Heinlein. So
that is a pretty eclectic range of, yeah, sources to draw upon. And your own writing is quite eclectic as well, because you have like fantasy and science fiction. And do you have horror as well?
Yeah, I've done horror. Mostly it's been under other names. It's like I've written two vampire novels under my given name, S.A. Swinyarski. I've written a pair of werewolf books, historical novels set in the Middle Ages, A Wolf Breed and Wolf's Cross, that was under S.A. Swan, which may or may not come up under S. Andrew Swan search, you know, sort of depends. So yeah, I've been all over the map.
And do you find that has, oh, sorry, keep going.
Oh, and it's like in a completely different tone is my latest novel for DAW, Marked, which is, it's sort of urban fantasy, steampunky, zombie-ish novel that's really an homage to Zelazny's Amber series.
So again, those eclectic influences just all sort of like mashing up in there. I love that.
Yeah.
So do you find it difficult to jump between genres, or do you find that you need to do that because you're not satisfied with just like working in one genre and you sort of like need a break with each book to work on something new?
It's not a conscious decision. It's like, okay. I probably jump genres way more than is healthy for my career. It's like I instead of developing a fan base, I've developed several different fan bases. You know, it's like, that's not what I was thinking about when I was deciding what to write. So it's like I wrote stuff as it came to me. And it's like, it's only this late in my career I've been thinking about, okay, what should I do to, like, you know, develop my career in this direction? I still haven't gotten to that point because I got, like, sidetracked by offer to write something that I couldn't actually see myself refusing. So,
fair enough. So. And how have you managed to balance, because it's quite remarkable to me when someone has published almost a book a year for a quarter of a century by itself, like that's impressive, but it's almost more impressive that you've done that while balancing, it seems to me, like day jobs as well. How have you been able to stay sort of productive with that balance, and what are your productivity tips for writers?
Well, just, you know, in my case, it's just do it regularly. I mean, for the past 10 years or so, it's like my production has basically been in the morning before I do a day job. So, you know, I'd leave home early, get to the office around 7, right until 8, and the phone starts ringing, and do that every day. And that's actually one of the perks of the current situation, is the fact that I'm telecommuting now. So I've gotten essentially an extra 15, 20 minutes to write in the morning because I'm not doing the commute.
It's definitely an upside to
it. I've actually been more productive.
Nice. Okay. So you haven't found that the current issues with, all the coronavirus and stuff, you've still managed to like find a way to still keep being productive during that? Because I think that is something that like some writers struggle with during this time.
Well, like I said, I've actually been more productive during this. I mean, when I'm in the middle of a project, I tend to get really focused on it. And so external stressors don't affect me all that much. I may be unique in that regard. It's like, I mean, other people may have to deal with, their responses to the situation in order to write. I've just been fortunate that, you know, probably, a bit of ADHD or something that, like, focusing on something is something I do well, sometimes too well, but.
Fair enough. So talking more generally about your writing career, what are some of the most important lessons that you've learned over the different books you've published? And have there been any, I suppose, lessons that were particularly surprising to you that, you know, maybe you didn't understand until, you know, novel 10 or novel 20?
That one about, you know, you never stop learning how to do this thing is a really important one, especially when you realize that it's not just the writing part of it that applies to. I'm discovering, basically how to navigate the current landscape, and I still haven't like figured out the publishing landscape yet. I mean, I'm still working my way into it, even at, you know, having, you know, 26 novels under my belt. It's like still, publishing an indie novel is, you know, stressful and not necessarily an automatic success, but you know, a large part of the industry is drifting that direction, so I can't really ignore it. And, you know, I think being willing to adapt yourself as the situation around you changes is an important thing. I'm trying to practice what I'm preaching there, but it's like, you know, it's, you know, I'm in my 50s, and it's like, it's hard to get some of these ingrained ideas out of my head. But, you know, it's like, you know, about 5 years ago, I realized, you know, if I'm at a con and somebody asks me how to get published nowadays, it's like, I don't know what to tell them. It's like, I could tell you how to get published in 1992.
Just hop in that time travel machine, but go back, like, and use the advice.
It's like, you know, when I'm dealing with my peers now, it's like anybody that's, you know, in their writing and that they're in their 30s, it's like their experience getting into print is completely different than mine. It's almost as much of a difference nowadays between the way I became a writer and the way people are now becoming writers as it was between the people who grew up writing for the pulps in the 30s and the 40s versus the people wrote for mass market paperbacks, you know, in the 60s and 70s. I mean, it's that much of a difference in the industry.
It is a huge change. And I'm very curious to hear about your thoughts on indie publishing, because my understanding is that you're sort of going into that. I'm a very like early stage indie published author myself. So it is quite like interesting to me to see someone who's had such a long career with you, and you have such a massive backlist of books. How are you going about tackling indie publishing, and could you just talk through a little bit of that decision in some more detail?
It's, you know, I'm still in the sort of learning phase of it. So I have, you know, as sort of a proof of concept, brought one of my out of print books back to life on Amazon, and have that listed. And I got a couple of others reverted, where the rights have reverted, that I'm in the pipeline to do that. But the project I mentioned that I couldn't refuse, it's like that's taken up most of my time. And it's like everything I have as far as writing goes is being devoted to that, which I unfortunately can't really talk about. it's one of those where I have to wait until the publicity department decides to make an announcement. And
sounds exciting though.
It is. I mean, I can talk about it in broad strokes. I mean, I had to go to Los Angeles to meet with the director involved in it, and I was sort of blown away at it, like how on the same page we actually were on the nature of this project, and that, you know, held true basically through all our communications. It's like, you know, we seem to be on the same wavelength here, which I guess is why, you know, he chose me. It's like he saw something in my writing that, you know, clicked with him, and I seem to be clicking with him. So fingers crossed, this should be probably within the year being announced. So
cool.
You know, and it's a semi-big deal, so.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to, hopefully hearing updates on that towards the end of 2020 as we are all emerging from our caves back into the world.
Yeah, I'm just hoping that this situation hasn't, like, you know, caused any upheavals in that project, because it's like, you know, Hollywood's one of those industries that is really feeling the heat from everybody being locked down. It's like, you know, the movies aren't being released, and it's like, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, it is a kind of a crazily big industry that, yeah, a lot of people don't even sort of appreciate that it almost is an industry in a way. But I suppose when you are a writer, you are very keyed into to everything involved with that. What would you say are your biggest writing strengths and your biggest writing weaknesses?
I think my strengths are probably, plotting and, action sequences. I've been told that, and, I do seem to have a good ability of, visualizing what's happening in a scene and staging it so that it gets across to the reader without confusing them. I think probably my weakest point, and again, people have told me that, is it's like, it's like I tend to have struggles with characterization, not necessarily having, characters act without motive, but probably more coming up with characters that, people have a deeper connection to. It's like, a lot of times I come up with characters that, people like, they have a, they enjoy the surface, but they're not like really, horribly emotionally invested in them. So, I work on that a lot. And, I do tend to write these action potboilers, which tend to sort of gloss over that part of the, the literary spectrum. So it may be just a side effect of what I've been writing.
Fair enough. How did you manage character arcs in something like Sword of the Slayer, which is interactive? So it doesn't really give you as the author like a huge amount of control necessarily over how, yeah, like a character that is not the protagonist, experiences their arc and their transformation throughout the story. How did you go through that process?
Well, it's really, the arcs are more or less driven by the various choices. So it's like, when you're, it's like the plot, really. As a matter of fact, it probably counts as a portion of the plot. So when the character in the choice of games makes a choice, they're informing the action of the subsequent scene, but they're also having an effect on their character arc because they've, expressed their character through the making of this decision. So the protagonist's personality is going to be, necessarily exhibited differently subsequent to that. In addition, the characters around them, the population of the rest of the story, all have some rippling effect from that choice. Now, it may not be, that granular, but just in general, the choices the character is making is influencing the reactions of the characters around them. So it's not just one character arc, it's like multiple arcs, so that, the character, the protagonist may end up in a different place, but so will, the various characters around them.
So it's sort of this thing where you've woven the character arc into the plot, and then the plot is sort of defined by the player's choices and everything. So it creates this sense of the characters responding to how you do.
Yeah, I mean, one of the definitions of plot is simply the sequence of cause and effect in a story. So, something happens because that happened, something happens because this happened. And that chain of events is what the plot actually is. And when you look at it, the characters' choices, not just in choice of games, but in any piece of fiction, are one of the main drivers of the plot. So, in a way, the the person's character is not a separate entity from the plot. It's like the motivations of the protagonists are going to be, you know, one of the things that drives the plot. The motivations of the antagonist is going to be driving the plot, and those are both driven by the character of these individuals. So, you know, you can't really get away from having, you know, characterization in a novel. And that's why, you know, it's like, if you don't have that characterization, you have, you know, basically cardboard characters. It's like cutouts that are just sort of like doing things because the plot requires it of them.
Yeah, you definitely don't want that. And I think that's one of the great strengths of the choice of games medium and just interactive fiction in general, is it really puts the emphasis on choice. And I think for writing linear fiction that is not interactive, that's still a really useful thing to be considering, is like, how can you be giving characters difficult choices to reveal who they are under pressure, and yeah, to make the story have that conflict and that excitingness to it. What are your world-building tips and lessons for, you know, building interesting science fiction and fantasy worlds?
Well, one of the more important things I think is like in world-building is keep notes on what you're doing and remain consistent with the implications of what you're doing. So that's going to apply whether you outline it, whether you pants it. It's like, if you bring something up, think through the implications of that thing, and, you know, make sure you resolve it, because it's that can often be another form of dangling plot thread. It's like, one glaring example of that is, and, you know, it's sort of grandfathered into the whole franchise, but it's still a little irksome that Star Trek has not ever really examined the implications of the transporter, what that technology could actually do. And people have just sort of like, I don't know if it's an apocryphal story or not, but I believe that the reason transporter exists in the Star Trek universe in the first place is because the original series did not have the budget to show people landing on a planet.
That would make a lot of sense, actually.
So they came up with the transporter, but yeah, it's like, it's like, from, you know, okay, you can't transport through somebody's shields, but why can't you transport a whole bunch of photon torpedoes right next to the Klingon ship?
It'd be a very effective weapon if they actually used it to the fullest extent. Yeah.
And then they bring up other things like, you know, bringing back people that have been, frozen in this transporter matrix, sometimes creating duplicates. And it's like, this raises all sorts of existential questions that never actually get addressed. I mean, you know, it's canon that there are two Rikers running around. It's like, are you saying this is the only time this has happened? It's like, this is, you know, it's like, there's just all sorts of weird things that are implied by that technology. But
I always find it very interesting when, yeah, someone looks at all the loopholes that exist in kind of like a fictional world, and yeah, looks at all the ways that someone who actually sat down to think about it for a bit could exploit all of those things. There's a really good like fan fiction story of Harry Potter called Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality, and it's basically this. It's basically like, you know, let's exploit the fact that that the owls in the world can magically find anyone that you address a letter to, even if you don't know where they are. Why wouldn't we just attach like a hand grenade to an owl and mail it to Voldemort, for instance? And all of those loopholes are so satisfying. to see people work through. What is the best writing advice? Oh, sorry, keep going. Yeah.
Well, like I said, it's like what you need to do is, like, you know, when you're building your story, is like go after it like one of these people goes after, like, you know, Harry Potter or Star Trek. It's like, you know, make sure that you leave as little of the loopholes in there as possible.
And sometimes those loopholes are actually some of the most interesting parts of your story, when you realize that, like, hey, this magic system, if you combined it with this magic system or this piece of technology, it could lead to this sort of unexpected outcome, and you could have a very interesting solution to problems that the characters are facing because of that. So I think that is definitely a really good tip.
Yeah, and that in fact can be like a really satisfying experience for the reader. It's like if you deliberately leave this unexplained loophole in your system, and then you later on have a character actually exploit it to get out of a problem, it's like the reader who actually was, thought you'd left this thing hanging is actually now pulled into the story because I saw that.
Yeah, it's so satisfying when that happens. And yeah, it's like one of the coolest experiences to have that sort of cognitive dissonance from these issues with the world actually be something that has a strong sense of purpose to it. That's really good. Yeah. What is the best writing advice you have ever received?
It takes persistence. That's basically it. I mean, it takes persistence to, like, write a novel. It takes a persistence to, you know, market a novel. It's like to get it into print, you know, be it traditionally or, indie. It's like, you know, all requires you to just keep going at it.
So fair enough. It's pretty inspiring to hear that and to see that you're continuing to going strong after so many novels published and such a, like, long career, and that you're still trying new things, you know, the choice of game stuff, the indie publishing thing, and whatever other project that you are working on in top secret right now. That's very great.
That is that in and of itself is a completely new experience for me, and I'm actually enjoying myself, so I'm hoping that this actually leads to more things. So
I know you can't talk too much about the experience, but have there been any interesting lessons or insights into writing that you've sort of taken from it so far?
I guess the interesting thing is, it's like when you're playing with somebody else's universe, it's like you need a couple of two things. One is you need to respect that universe. I mean, you need to sort of understand deep down what the creators were trying to do and be as true as you can to that vision. And also that writing it is a lot like writing a historical novel, in that in a historical novel, you have this whole list of events and things that happened that you can't change. It's like, it happened. So it's like, you know, if you're writing an accurate historical novel, it's like, you know, these things happened in this order with these people involved. So you can't, you need to basically write in sort of like the interstitial spaces. It's like that's where you have your creativity. Writing in the places we can't see. So in terms of adapting somebody else's work, from a visual medium, it's like one of those interstitial spaces is the, you know, inner lives of the characters. And sort of the sensory, aside from sight and sound, the sensory experiences of the characters is where you get to, like, you know, express your creativity in that venue. It's an interesting experience.
That's awesome. I think this is a really good place to wrap it up. That sounds like you are working on some super interesting projects at the moment, and I hope to stay updated with those in the future. Is there anything else that you'd like to mention or anything of that nature before we wrap this up?
Well, it's like, as far as my books go, it's like most of them are on Amazon. One thing about writing for dog books is they keep most of the stuff in print. So it's 90% of what I've written you can find on Amazon. Just look for S. Andrew Swan. The latest thing, Marked, my sort of Zelazny homage, just came out in mass market paperback this past January. So, you know, you can find me on Facebook as S. Andrew Swan. And I'm on Twitter as S. Andrew Swan, although I don't tweet much.
You posted some really good memes about covers of those old Amazing Stories magazines. They were fantastic. I was looking at those before you started talking and got a lot of enjoyment out of those.
Yeah, I had fun making those. I should make some more of those.
Yeah, please do. All right. Well, Stephen, this has been really great. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And yeah, once again,
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I'll put links to everything that we've talked about in the show notes. So listeners/viewers, if you want to check out some of the things we have been discussing, have a look at those. Stephen, thanks again. And I hope you stay safe and I hope your projects keep being great.
Oh, thank you. And good luck with the podcast.
Thank you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.